The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Well, hello there. This is Fred Brack from the Triangle Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten, as it always is, by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached by calling 919-781-1973. Well, I went on a trip. And that airplane air blowing down on me gave me a little bit of an upper respiratory thing going on here. So I apologize if you hear me clear my throat or turn off the microphone like that to cough or take a sip of water. We'll get through this. We have been reading from the July 2018 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. The theme this month has been a summer mountain getaway. You may have to listen a little closer this month because I'm not going to be speaking as loudly as usual. We just turn up that mic volume a little bit. We are going to read as a first article, continuing in our Summer in Jackson County section, Beyond the Valley. Well, this is a nice pastoral scene out here. There's a beautiful home. It's two stories high with very large windows on the second floor, story on the front. It's got a marvelous fireplace at one end of the house. It probably serves the inside of the house, but there's also a fireplace on the outside of the house, and there's four Adirondack chairs surrounding this very large opening on the stone fireplace. It looks like there might be a little woodshed there on the right or something, and a covered opening on the left. There's a fence around the front of the house. The lawn is a beautiful green. There's some low shrubs. There's some lovely trees in the background. Then at the end of the nicely mowed property, there is a forest, and it gives way to a lot of stone. It's a mountain with very steep drop-off on it against a big, puffy cloud in a blue sky. Just a gorgeous picture. It says, built on land that's been in the Jennings family since 1895, Canyon Kitchen Restaurant keeps a family's legacy alive. Beyond the Valley, in Sapphire, a majestic box canyon, the largest one east of the Mississippi, provides a feast for the eyes and for the first taste of Canyon Kitchen's seasonal sensory experience, written by Sherry Castle. The scenic two-lane road to Lonesome Valley corkscrews so tightly that a GPS thinks the car is making turns, not banking curves. On the edge of another swerve, a sign pokes out of a Nantahala National Forest, marking the entrance to a drive that wends over a couple more rolling hills to a spot unseen and unimaginable from the highway. If you arrive at dusk, around dinner time, to hear Canyon Kitchen before you see it, distant laughter and chatter carried on the breeze, people having a lively supper, delighted by their good fortune to be gathered in such a beautiful spot. The porch lights and glowing windows of the restaurant, housed in the Jennings barn, seem to beckon, "Come in, come in." But if you arrive during the day, you might not hear anything, no matter what's going on, because nothing can compete with the sight of the 1,400-foot stone edifice that serves as the soaring backdrop of the restaurant. Canyon Kitchen is part of a development in an area known as Lonesome Valley, situated midway between Sapphire and Cashiers. Laurel Knob soars above the valley, which has two other steep sides that combine to make it the largest box canyon east of the Mississippi River. It's a singular sight not only in the North Carolina mountains, but also in the entire length of the Appalachian chain. As the expression goes, you have to see it to believe it. There's only one road in and out, and guests catching the first glimpse of the canyon, which one might expect to see in Yosemite, not Jackson County, are wonderstruck. The first time I pulled into the valley, I thought the view was unreal. As in, it wasn't actually real. It seemed like a set out of a movie, laughs Sarah Jennings, Lonesome Valley's special events and marketing director. Jennings not only works on the property, she also lives there with her husband, Richard Gundry Jennings IV, and their children. And yet, she says, the beauty and magnificence of this place still surprise me every day. Millions of years ago, granite walls heaved upward to form this canyon, a prehistoric view that is framed for diners at every turn. On the veranda that spills out behind the restaurant, guests take in the sweep of it. The canyon, gardens, forest, and meadow. A long gallery walk of living landscapes. Inside, tall windows capture the closest rock face, called Cow Rock Mountain, for its natural cow-shaped outline. As it darkens with the evening sky, the romp of shadows created by mercurial mountain weather ensures that we never see the canyon the same way twice. Private estates and home sites dot the property, which has been called Lonesome Valley since the 1950s. The name makes reference to local lore about a hunter who endured a cold, lonely night in the dense virgin forest before he made his way out. The Jennings family connection to the land begins even earlier than that. In 1895, family patriarch E.H. Jennings and several industrialists from Pittsburgh purchased 35,000 acres in the Highlands Cashier Plateau to log the timber as an investment. Tracts were sold over the years, and in the 1940s, grandson Richard Jennings Jr., a Yale-educated engineer, became the first family member to see Lonesome Valley as a place to put down roots. Determined to preserve the remaining 800 acres, he built a family homestead and, along with his three children, Dick, Binford, and Sally, started a series of family-run businesses, including Sunburst Trout Farms, which continues to operate from its headquarters in nearby Waynesville. When it was time for the children to take over, they realized that change was inevitable. So, to preserve their father's commitment to the land, they decided to allow development. But only if they could oversee it themselves. In 2005, a private gated community with stately homes cropped up across Lonesome Valley. The recession in 2008 forced the family to regroup again, just as they had in generations past, to keep the land and the remarkable view in their own hands. To that end, Sally Jennings Hudson and Chef John Fleer, now the chef and owner of Asheville's acclaimed rhubarb, decided to transform the barn, which had been built as a rec center for the development, into a destination restaurant showcasing farm-fresh ingredients from local sources. Open only a few days a week, and serving a set menu that changed daily, Canyon Kitchen launched on Memorial Day 2009. The remoteness of the location, the surrounding beauty, and the emphasis on farm to fork at a time when that trend had not yet become a national movement, brought curious diners wending through the hills as though on a culinary pilgrimage. Soon enough, the once Lonesome Valley had a new crop of admirers. Canyon Kitchen started small and has grown to now serve as a neighborhood gathering place, a favorite stop for people living in nearby communities, and a special dining spot for Jackson County tourists. Even the kitchen boasts a million-dollar view. H. Chef, who has worked in it, has drawn inspiration from the landscape, elevating Appalachian ingredients in lovely new ways. Today, the menu is in the hands of executive chef Ken Naron, who has worked in the cashier's area for years. In keeping with the original restaurant's philosophy, his dishes feature seasonal ingredients at their peak from mountain farms and orchards. We can't raise everything we need, so we cultivate relationships with those who can, Naron says. Cooking requires relationships. He and his staff can harvest a few things, however, from the small kitchen's garden that's only a few steps out the back door of the restaurant. Guests are encouraged to stroll along the rows as part of their visits. Fragrant herbs and vegetables tumble out of raised beds and containers, including repurposed 1950s-era trout raceways and water troughs, vestiges of the trout farm years. For Naron, the act of gardening is a form of planning for the future, as is putting up the homemade pickles, vinegars, and preserves that stock his larder. Rows of jars holding jewel-colored veggies offer a reminder of each season in Lonesome Valley. There's no use preserving something if you don't believe in a future where it will be needed and used, he says. The original Canyon Kitchen menu offered a slate of dishes selected by Chef Fleer. No choices, not that any were needed. Subsequent chefs tweaked the restaurant's approach to reflect their own culinary vision. And the menu has expanded a bit. Naron's fixed prix menu changes often, but few items, such as the fried okra chips and sunburst trout, make a frequent appearance. To eat at Canyon Kitchen is to feel like a dinner guest at the Jennings home. It's an invitation to be part of a family legacy, too. Faces of earlier generations rendered in oil portraits keep watch over the stairs. Warm chatter and high laughter rise to the rafters as the view outside fades into the dark, starry night. The dining room is tall and airy, with sturdy oak beams running the length of the room, holding up the ceiling as though it were a canopy. Huge barn doors slide and swing open to reveal a broad yard that seems to lead right to the foot of the Bucks Canyon walls. On the lawn, lightning bugs bedazzle the darkness at knee level. Before and after dinner, guests gather at zinc-topped tables on the patio. Here, the lowest limbs of the trees planted along the perimeter are trimmed so that they frame the canyon view from the dining room rather than block it. On warm days, mountain breezes waft through. On cool evenings, patio heaters glow, and the large outdoor fireplace is ablaze, playing to an audience seated near the hearth or taking a stroll. Sarah Jennings says she hopes that all these special touches give the restaurant longevity so that future generations might discover the canyon. Because, she says, there is no more beautiful place in the world. You are listening to Our State Magazine on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. If you have any comments on our program, please call the studios 919-832-5133. 38. Here's a short article now on the subject of wildflowers, really. It says, Into the Woods. Come July, Jackson County wildflowers pop with color. A walk through a quiet cove forest reveals the new blooms of plant species as old as the hills. Rose Bay rhododendron. Unlike Catawba rhododendrons, which are often admired on mountain peaks and balds, the Rose Bay rhododendron loves the acidic soil of cave forests. One of the hardiest and largest rhododendrons, these rhodies, as they're often called, frequently form dense thickets known locally as laurel hells. So, yeah, stay on the trail. Big classic rhododendron leaves at the bottom and pretty white flowers with little pistols inside, and each one of the sets of petals, and there are five of them for each flower, one of them has some, seems to have some yellow in it, unless that's another part of the flower. You really can't tell from the painting, but everyone has a little yellow sticking up. A galax. This plant's broad, heart-shaped green leaves are so iconic that people have been known to poach them for floral arrangements. In early summer, galax also shoots out white, spear-like flowers that are hard to miss. That is, if the plant's distinctive earthy aroma doesn't catch your attention first. Of course, I can't tell the size of the plant from the photo here because this is just an artist's rendition of a portion of it, but you see a big leaf, which really kind of looks like a heart. It bows in at the top and comes to a little bit of a point at the bottom, and then it bows in from top to bottom in the center, kind of concave. And then lying across it is the pretty white flowers on a stem. There's like 25 of them, very small, held tightly against the stem, which is long and narrow. Cardinal flower. This vibrant flower does share certain similarities with our beloved state bird. A familiar bloom in Europe, its name was already in use by 1629, most likely a nod to the color of the vestments worn by Roman Catholic cardinals. Tall, thin leaves, and in front of them, beautiful red petals. And some of the petals are closed up. They haven't opened yet. And the others are wide open. Ironweed. Like a purple torch in the meadow, these bright flowers atop their tall stems add drama to the landscape. The monarch butterfly-friendly blooms may look delicate, but their stems are rugged and their roots are difficult to dig up. Hence the imposing name, ironweed. And it is tall stems. We see two leaves branching out and then two thick stems coming out of those leaves, and each one has multiple branches from it, and at the very ends, these very colorful purple flowers open up. Wild quinine. From a distance, these clusters of white blooms look like pearls and have a faint medicinal fragrance, which is only fitting since the plant has long been used to heal both people and animals. The leaves, contain tannin, which is believed to aid in the treatment of burns. Native American tribes made a thick paste with the leaves and used the ashes of burned leaves to treat their horses' sore backs. Pretty white clusters. They remind me of Lily of the Valley, which is really I don't know if they have any around here, but a New England type of a flower, that size flower all clustered together at the end of each leaf, or at the end of each stem, rather. Black-eyed Susan. These days, you're just as likely to see this classic sun-loving flower in your neighbor's backyard as you are to see it in the wild. A traditional Native American medicinal herb, black-eyed Susans are believed to be a remedy for, among other things, fevers, colds, swelling, and snake bites. But we'll just settle for a mason jar full of the blooms. Probably are familiar with these, the yellow flowers, or yellow petals, rather, coming out and then drooping downward toward the ground, and in the center of this black ball, which has a little something on the end of it, and that's why it's called a black-eyed Susan. Sourwood. True sourwood honey, with its rich, spicy flavor and caramel texture, is prized by honey purists worldwide. But bees can only make sourwood honey during a short summer window, and its harvest is affected by weather fluctuations. In the Appalachian Mountains, the bell-shaped white flowers that bloom for some 25 days in summer are sometimes called angel fingers. The actual little white blossoms of this are not dissimilar from the wild quinine, and I mentioned Lily of the Valley. It's another plant that reminds me of the Lily of the Valley with the small, white, compact flowers. Bee balm, with its bright fragrance and pretty pink white or red colors. Bee balm is a favorite of bees, butterflies, hummingbirds, and, yes, hikers. Its citrus scent, one of many nicknames, is bergamot, as in bergamot orange, belies the fact that this wildflower is part of the mint family, with a long history of medicinal uses. Many Native American tribes recognized the plant's antiseptic properties and used it in poultices to treat skin infections and minor wounds. And finally, wildflower walks and hikes. North Carolina's mountains are one of the most biologically diverse regions in the world, so when outdoor author Jim Parnum decided to write a guide to the area's wealth of blooms, he had his work cut out for him. Included in his book are 59 different hiking routes, habitat descriptions, tips on peak bloom periods, and a wildflower identification checklist. You might end up on top of a grassy bald or gazing at a waterfall, but one goal remains: find the flowers. We're going to go back to the beginning of the book right now because I don't think we quite have time to finish the last article in the book. And we're going to pick one out here right about page 50. Because that's the right length of an article. So let's do it. Dance Hall Days. The weathered clubhouse that sits on the edge of a farm pond in Randolph County may be faded, but the memories made there are still vibrant. It's been 65 years since Cleo Barker last walked through the door. That's a lot of water over the dam. Cleo clasps his hands together, ducks his head, and steps into the past. Hoo-wee, he calls out. Golly, he croons. Oh, my Lord, boy, he says to no one in particular. I could tell you a story. And he does. The last time Cleo was inside the old Sizemore Lake Dance Hall, just a few long frog hops from tiny downtown Liberty, the place was packed, wall to wall. Cars jammed the field outside. The bump and thump of the band echoed over the pond. And the soldiers, boy, I tell you, he says, them boys from the 82nd Airborne in Fayetteville would come down, and those girls from UNCG would meet them, and Lord have mercy, what a time! Cleo's grandfather, a regionally famous dance caller named Hugh Dillon, started calling Appalachian square dances at the Sizemore Lake Dance Hall around 1848 or so. Cleo was 8 or 9 years old. He wouldn't bring me here on Friday nights, he grins. Things could get a little rough. But he'd bring me on Saturday, and he'd call those dances, and the people were just shoulder to shoulder, and good Lord, look at this place. It hasn't changed a bit. Just outside the door, W.G. Dub and Shearer Bridges watch quietly. Dub grew up on this family farm, remembering picking up the beer cans on Saturday mornings, remembers watching hands reach up to unscrew the bare light bulbs when the slow dance music played. The couple knows what a treasure had been handed down to their care. And they know the dance hall roof needs replacing. They know the snow blows through the windows and the paint is peeling. They wonder how they'll keep this place up, this place that had been the heart and soul of their family for generations. They wrestle with the quandary of what their responsibilities are when fate hands to your care 2,700 square feet of forgotten history. Cleo takes a deep breath, and I wonder if he can't just see how much everything has changed after all. Sizemore Lake is really a large pond, 17 acres of quiet water, ringed with trees and pasture. It's not all that different from countless other farm ponds dotting rural North Carolina, except for the sprawling, historic oak-floored dance hall that overlooks the pond dam and its singular place in history. In the 1940s, as World War II was winding down, military bases swelled with soldiers. At Fort Bragg, Cleo says soldiers on weekend passes were confined to a 50-mile radius of the base. Dance halls cropped up from across the region, mostly built to overlook farm ponds, and for a few years you could barely hear a bullfrog on Friday or Saturday night for the old-time music and the Appalachian square dance callers singing out the steps. Circle left, weave the ring, clover leaps, swing her easy now. And the Sizemore Lake Dance Hall may well be the last one of its era still standing. After a memorable run as a dance hall, a small part of the place had a long and beloved second act as a prized fishing hole for locals. For many years, Dub's grandmother spent her days at the pond in the old drinks room of the dance hall. She sold RC colas, moon pies, and fishing worms, Shearer tells me. She loved that pond, was down there every day with her cash box. It cost 50 cents to fish, a dollar to rent a boat. But the family began to worry about her safety and knew that it simply wasn't practical to run a fishing pond business. The drinks room of the dance hall was abandoned. The whole place was closed down up until the 2000s when they began to use it a few times a year for family reunions and church Christmas socials. Hardly anyone knew much about its glory days until Cleo Barker walked in the door. I ask Shearer if the clubhouse ever feels like a burden. Not a burden, she says thoughtfully, but it's a handful because every time you fix something, you find three other things to fix, she says, with a resolve that suggests that she will do whatever it takes. But with the challenges of loving an old farm pond dance hall, there's new hope. The Bridges' daughter and son-in-law have moved to the farm, and a granddaughter, a sixth generation to live by the pond, has now inherited the family's love for the water and the rolling fields that give way to the pond's edge, and the old white building that was old and abandoned the first time Shearer saw it. After we say goodbye to Cleo, I walk the dozen steps to the edge of the pond where the white walls of the dance hall are reflected in the quiet waters near the shore. Shearer is right. Down to the mossy tree bark of the old catalpa trees that shade the water, everything is a little weathered here, a little worn. Except for the pond. When the breeze dies for just a moment, from the surface of the water near the shore turns to glass, the reflection of the tree branches reaching across the old clubhouse windows look like the hands of dancers. It reminds me of a sign tacked long ago above one of the dance hall's doors. The best thing to hold on to in life is each other. And they do so. The old dance hall and the farm pond and this caretaking family, six generations now, all leaning into each other as the strains of old-time country music fade away and the spring peepers and the bullfrogs fill the silence. And that one was written by T. Edwards Nickens. His Ramblin' Man column appears monthly in Our State magazine. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, triangleredingservice.org. If you have any comments or any questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.